Hi, I'm Neil Stavem. Here's the podcast for Connecting Faith. Enjoy the conversation.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Nice to have you along on the broadcast today. Thanks so much for tuning in. I'm Neil Stavem. This is Connecting Faith. Ted Ross at the controls, and happy Thanksgiving, Ted. I was off yesterday traveling, so I wanted to say hope you had a wonderful Thanksgiving weekend.
It was great to be with family and some good friends, and I'm glad that you had safe travels and are back.
Yeah. You still have turkey in the refrigerator?
The leftover? I don't know. I think we cleaned it out pretty
well.
Did you?
Now, okay. All right. Now, there's an old joke you used to reference once in a while. It says, of all the things I've lost, I miss my mind the most, which is a funny line. But we're going to talk today about the mind because there are many in our midst whose minds have been afflicted, affected, and impacted by some disorders, which is an area that we don't really spend a lot of time talking about, certainly as Christians, about mental illness.
Yeah,
but it is a reality.
People get scared off and they don't know quite what to say or what to do. So this will be a real helpful conversation today. Yeah.
And, the fact is that, sadly, that, many men and women diagnosed with mental disorders are told they just need to pray more or turn from their sin. Yeah. And mental illness is maybe equated with demonic possession sometimes, or weak faith, or generational sin. So we're going to address those issues today, and how does the church, minister to those with mental illness, which is one of the reasons why our guest wrote the book he did called Grace for the Afflicted, A Clinical and Biblical Perspective on Mental Illness. And it's an honor to welcome Matthew Stanford to the broadcast. Dr. Stanford is a clinical neuroscientist. He's CEO of the Hope and Healing Center and Institute in Houston, Texas. He also serves as an adjunct professor in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at Baylor College of Medicine and the Department of Psychology at the University of Houston. He and his family reside in Houston, actually in the second floor of their place now, part of the recovery from the flood. So, Matthew, welcome to Connecting Faith, and we are sorry for your loss of the home, and I'm sure that many others in your community are just dealing with this ongoing recovery thing, which we've kind of, it's dropped off the front page, but I'm sure it's still front page for you, isn't it?
Yeah, thanks for having me. Yeah, it's an everyday event around here. There's a lot of people are displaced, a lot of damage.
Yeah. This issue, mental illness is one that we as Christians, maybe everybody has some questions or misunderstanding about it, but want to just go through and talk about as much as we can cover here about, particularly what God's Word has to say about this and get a right perspective. Let's start with just the idea. Is mental illness a real illness?
It is a real illness. I think there's a lot of kind of misperceptions or misunderstanding of that. I mean, disorders like schizophrenia and bipolar disorder are very serious brain disorders. In which the individual, we can demonstrate that the individual's brain is not functioning normally. Things like depression, anxiety, while they certainly have subclinical manifestations, when you're talking about someone with major depressive disorder, you're talking about someone who has a very serious medical disorder that unless there's some type of intervention, they won't be able to function normally.
So in the same category as like heart disease or diabetes, I mean,
absolutely. You can think of it as a chronic condition, much like diabetes or hypertension, something like that. We can't cure the illnesses, but we certainly can manage them. I think diabetes is probably one of the best comparisons because people with diabetes, they always will have diabetes, but diabetes can be managed to a point that it really is just a little more than a nuisance.
And is it the same in generally with the mental disorders, that it's manageable given the right kind of treatment?
Yes, absolutely. When people receive treatment, 80% or more of those individuals will show significant recovery. And the real problem is that in the United States today, a majority of people with mental illness receive no treatment.
Oh, well, and is that because it's just hasn't been diagnosed, or we don't know enough about to tell me more? Why is that?
Well, it's It's a number of reasons, but the primary reasons are, stigma and shame. People don't want to kind of out themselves, and so they don't go and get service, or their family doesn't allow them to go get service. And then secondly, finances play a huge role. Most insurances pay for very little to no mental health care, and so most of mental health care is paid out of pocket. And so it's expensive, and people can't afford it. So, I mean, there's a lot of other issues. We don't have enough mental health care providers. There's very few psychiatric beds in the United States anymore. But, you know, some of the statistics are very disturbing. I mean, there are 10 times more mentally ill people in prison than there are in psychiatric beds. And, you know, in 44 out of 50 states, the largest psychiatric facility in the state is a jail. So, I mean, it's a disturbing thing. I mean, most of the mentally ill people, we push them out onto the streets or into jails. And the majority of people receive no care. So it's a horrible, horrible, situation that we're in here in the U.S. But, you know, one of the great statistics that drives what we do here at the Hope and Healing Center is that individuals that are dealing with these issues are more likely to seek out a clergy before a mental health care provider or physician. And that's anyone in the general population, not just people that are associated with faith communities. So when someone is first dealing with distress, they may not even realize they have a mental health care problem. They have a tendency to go to clergy first or to churches because it's easy to get in and it's free and you can see somebody and they'll talk to you. And I think it's a real divine opportunity for the church to really be able to help people that have really been really broken by some pretty significant illness.
Well, that does bring up the, kind of the main topic for our discussion today is that how does the church typically respond? And as we mentioned, that oftentimes, we're told to pray more or turn from sin. I mean, is there a spiritual component to mental illness?
I mean, I think there's a spiritual component to everything. That would kind of be my pat answer. I mean, I think, yeah, there is. I think that God made us spiritual and non-spiritual. We're physical and non-physical. So when we're affected by something that, causes us suffering or damages us in some way, it affects us spiritually as well. I think that, when somebody asks that, and I know you're not asking it this way, but if somebody asks that and the real question behind that is this really have a spiritual genesis to it? In that, is bipolar disorder a sin or weak faith or the demonic? I don't think these illnesses are any different than any other illness. I certainly think that the demonic might use these illnesses against someone. I mean, the demonic uses weaknesses against us. But I don't know that somebody with schizophrenia is any more afflicted by the demonic than someone who has cancer, because I really see those disorders really no different. They're both physical disorders, but they certainly have spiritual aspects to them because they affect a person's ability to grow spiritually, to have relationship with God. And so I think I look at it as very holistic in that, I think all of these have a spiritual aspect. And I think we need to intervene on a spiritual level for these individuals, just like we would intervene on a spiritual level for any illness.
Well, I was thinking too, I guess that maybe we overreact one way or the other. I mean, because maybe would some say, well, this is the lack of faith and, that it's a sin issue. But then maybe on the other side, we wouldn't account for any sort of, demonic activity. And that probably is a mistake on the other side as well, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, if you were just to say, well, this is just a physical illness and it has no spiritual aspect to it. Now, I will say that we do that in the church, I think, all the time for what we typically refer to as physical illnesses, the person with diabetes. Does diabetes have a spiritual aspect? Well, certainly it does, because we have a spiritual aspect to our being, and the person is suffering from this illness, and it affects their ability to function, it affects their ability to work, it affects their ability to relate. I mean, so it's going to affect them spiritually. Now, there may be more or less spiritual effect, but we have a tendency to over kind of go one way with these quote-unquote physical illnesses, and then we go way the other way with mental illness. And I think we just need more of a balanced approach and kind of, recognize that, everything affects us wholly. So it affects our body, our mind, our spirit, our relationships. And the church has a role to play in any type of illness that we might be dealing with.
Talking today with Matthew Stanford. Dr. Stanford serves as he's a clinical neuroscientist, and he's CEO of the Hope and Healing Center and Institute in Houston, Texas. He He also is adjunct professor at the Baylor College of Medicine and at the University of Houston. And he's written a wonderful resource called Grace for the Afflicted, A Clinical and Biblical Perspective on Mental Illness. This has been revised and updated just recently. And we're going to talk about what has been updated in this. But I do want to mention that we have some copies to give away. And this may be something that's very close to you and your family, and you would just like to get some great insight on that. Or if you're in a church staff some way and say, this is an area where we want to be better prepared as a team when people come our way that have some disorders of various kinds, and how can we more effectively give help and hope. And so you can call and be a part of our drawing for that book giveaway at 877-933-2484. Again, I've got three copies of Grace for the Afflicted to give away. 877-933-2484. And it may be that you have a question as well, and you're welcome to join us with your question or your comment as it relates to maybe mental disorders. Getting a clinical and biblical perspective on mental illness today with Dr. Matthew Stanford. And our phone lines are open at 877-93-FAITH. More in a moment. Scriptures tell us, you know, things like that, to set our mind on things above, and that we're to love the Lord our God with all our heart, soul, mind, and strength. And I know that, God cares about our minds as much as our bodies, our souls, spirits. So what do we do when we're dealing with some mental disorders? And there are many in our nation today that are affected with some disorder of one sort or another. And maybe they come to a church, and do they get good insight and advice there? We're talking about it today with Dr. Matthew Stanford, who's author of the book Grace for the Afflicted, A Clinical and Biblical Perspective on Mental Illness. And you know, before we maybe lay out what a biblical perspective would be, Matthew, just say a bit more about, maybe the sense of the scope of mental illness in our nation, and are there factors that cause these illnesses of the mind?
Yeah, we have a tremendous kind of mental health epidemic. About one out of every five Americans in a given year will meet criteria for a diagnosable mental illness. It's about 44 million Americans every year. In a lifetime, the lifetime prevalence is about 50%. So about 50% of the population is going to show at some point going to have be able to meet criteria for some type of mental illness. The problem is that the majority of people aren't treated. Now, the most common disorders are depressive disorders and anxiety disorders. Those are the most common, with things like schizophrenia being very rare. That only occurs in about 1% of the population. But I think most often that's what people think of when they think of mental illness, is they think of someone who's psychotic or delusional, who may think they're somebody else or think they have special powers or see things or hear things that aren't there. But that's actually very uncommon. That's more the rarity. As far as factors go, I think, the pretty common set of factors, early exposure to trauma is always a significant increaser of a later likelihood of a mental health problem. Being exposed to any type of trauma like poverty or abuse, neglect, things like that. If you have a mentally ill parent or a mentally ill loved one, first-degree relative, you're much more likely, about five times more likely than general population, to have a mental health problem as an adult. There's certainly a heritable aspect. These things do run in families, but it's a combination of nature and nurture that kind of bring them together. A really highly stressful environment, it doesn't necessarily have to be trauma, could also be a precipitating factor. I think that, head injuries, things like that, anything that would cause any kind of insult to the individual, particularly early on, can be an increaser of the likelihood that a person might have a mental health problem later in life.
You've been, teaching in the Department of Psychiatry and, neuroscience, all this. Does modern psychotherapy handle these issues well, would you say, or are there some shortcomings in our therapy strategies today?
Well, I mean, psychotherapy, which is a talking therapy, and there are many different forms of that. It is very effective for treating mental health problems as long as you're using a therapy that has been demonstrated to be effective with the given illness. And so, you know, one of the problems in mental health today is that, you know, there's lots of different types of psychotherapy that are practiced, but not all of them are necessarily been demonstrated to be effective. So, for instance, if you have depression, you want to have cognitive behavior therapy because CBT has been shown to be effective at treating depression and helping individuals with depression to recover, whereas you would want to have psychodynamic theory, which is our therapy, which is another approach. I would say, you know, some of the problems with psychology, psychiatry in general, is that, you know, the early fathers of the discipline really were no friends of the faith. They, you know, Freud, for instance, thought that religion was a neurosis in and of itself. He thought it was an illness by itself. And so, you know, there was a lot of kind of bad blood to begin with between faith and those things. Most of that's gone today. You know, spirituality is very, very much discussed and very much promoted within psychology and psychiatry. What I would say, though, is that, you know, a secular therapist who takes a very secular approach to therapy, who maybe isn't a person of faith and isn't open to that, is really more interested in trying to help the individual kind of find healing within themselves, and really may or may not be open to them, you know, incorporating faith into their therapy. And so I think, you know, what's important for a believer to, you know, find a therapist or a therapeutic environment that's very faith affirming. You know, I don't know that the person has to necessarily go to your church or something. I think that they need to be affirming of your faith, though. They need to recognize that you find your faith important, that God's presence and the healing power in your recovery is important, and they need to take that into account as you're kind of going through this therapeutic process. You don't want somebody to be there that's dismissive of your faith or being derogatory towards your faith. They need to be somebody that's very affirming of that.
So you're a church leader and also a professor of psychology and neuroscience, and, you know, you share in the book, you know, instances where people come up to you in church and ask questions about this or that. If you were developing a faith-affirming approach maybe in the church for a treatment of those with mental disorders, what would be some of the key aspects that you'd want to include as opposed to just saying you need to pray more and this is a demonic possession?
Well, I think, you know, I think that, you know, first off, I think we have to recognize that, you know, there's within in a mental disorder or a mental health problem, there's going to be physical aspects, there's going to be mental aspects, and so we have to kind of take a holistic approach. We have to say, you know, maybe medication is necessary, maybe psychotherapy is necessary, maybe pastoral care is, you know, all these things need to be involved. So let's take a very kind of broad-based approach, and typically you're not going to find one individual that can do all of that. So you want to kind of develop a mental health care team. So if I'm in a faith community, one of the things I want to do is I want that faith community to develop relationships with mental health care providers in the community so that they have people that they've already vetted and trust that they can refer their people to. I also want them to, you know, kind of understand what are the spiritual aspects of depression. How does a person that's depressed, you know, how are they affected? I mean, I've had more people than I could count that are depressed say to me, you know, I don't think God can hear me anymore. I don't think, you know, I don't feel like I'm worthy to pray to God. I mean, they feel separated from God, you know, and so versus somebody who has anxiety versus somebody that, you know, I mean, how are they affected spiritually? And so I think just educating yourself and then making sure you're connected to resources. And then I would say, you know, putting in place within the faith community things like support groups or peer counselors, peer coaches that can walk along with people. You know, I think really preparing yourself for a group of individuals who have significant need, but as I said before, are much more likely to go to faith communities seeking assistance before they ever go to any type of professional in the world.
Is maybe just talk about the role of prayer in, you know, dealing with, obviously maybe prayer is not the way to diagnose but or to overcome mental illness, or is it? I mean, say more about how prayer can be a key part in the recovery here?
Yeah, I think that, you know, I think prayer is very important. I think part of the problem comes in when somebody makes kind of a blanket statement that says, you know, you come up and you say, well, you know, I'm struggling with depression. Well, I'm going to pray for you. And I think it's wonderful, and I think they should pray for them. But if you apply that you're going to pray because this is a special spiritual issue and this is going to be taken care of, it would be much like you would pray for somebody for cancer. I think people with mental health problems should be prayed for healing. I believe in healing. I believe God intervenes at times and supernaturally heals people, but I also believe God heals through natural remedy. I think God is the healer, and when you're healed, he heals. I think people with mental health problems should be prayed for against the demonic. I think that the demonic is out to thwart the people and purposes of God, just like whether you're mentally ill or not. I hope people pray for me against the demonic. So I don't set it aside as separate, but I don't think we should ignore that. So I think that those are very important things. I think the problem comes in when you say, well, you've got bipolar disorder, and so we know that means that's demonic, and so, you know, we're going to do this deliverance ministry, whereas you would never have done the same thing for cancer. Again, I think that it's certainly, you know, it's a very common question I get. I think it's certainly possible for the demonic to make someone ill. I think that's what the scriptures say. But, you know, I question the discernment that we have, or maybe I might say the specificity in our discernment today. You know, I've had people tell me that they could tell when someone's, you know, mental illness was demonic, but they certainly can't do that when someone has cancer. And so what I would say is, you know, if you're a believer, I think that the demonic is out to get you, in a sense. You know, they're going to oppress you in some way. So I think being prayed for against the demonic is an important thing. I just don't think we set it aside as like the end-all, be-all of treatment. So I think prayer is tremendously important. I also think, you know, from a relational perspective, I think people that have mental health problems often feel like they're separated or shamed because there is a lot of stigma associated with it. And so I think praying with somebody that has mental health problems, you know, standing before the throne of God with them and lifting them up, you know, just being present with them, I think that's tremendously therapeutic and very helpful for them both spiritually and relationally.
We're going to continue the discussion in just a moment with Matthew Stanford, who serves as the CEO of Hope, the Hope and Healing Center and Institute in Houston, Texas. He's also an adjunct professor in behavioral sciences at Baylor College of Medicine and also the Department of Psychology at the University of Houston, written a great resource called Grace for the Afflicted, a clinical and biblical perspective on mental illness. And this has been recently revised and expanded. We have some copies to give away and would love to get one in your hands. It'd be a resource that could help you as you minister in this area. It's 877-933-2484 to sign up for the drawing. We'll do that at the top of the hour, 877-93-FAITH. You can get a copy of Grace for the Afflicted if you sign up. Coming up in a moment, we'll talk a little bit more about the biblical accounts of mental illness and what if there's instructive there as we understand more about what the Bible has to say about this important issue. Stay tuned for more on Connecting Faith. Mind of Christ. We're told we have the mind of Christ, and we want that mind to control all that we do and say, as that wonderful old hymn suggests. But there are many that perhaps over the course of a lifetime, as Dr. Stanford said, you know, 50% might experience some sort of mental disorder, which inhibits us from being all that perhaps God intended us to be. And many men and women diagnosed with mental disorders have been told they just need to pray more or turn from their sin and haven't gotten wise advice in church. Now, my guest today is not only a church leader, but also a professor of psychology and neuroscience, and he's offering a clinical and biblical perspective on mental illness. That's the title of his updated book, Grace for the Afflicted. Dr. Matthew Stanford is the CEO of the Hope and Healing Center and Institute in Houston, Texas. By the way, if you go to hopeandhealingcenter.org, you can find out more about their good work there. Matthew, just say a bit about biblical accounts as you do in the book. The Bible has illustrations of people that suffered mental disorders, and are they instructive if we look through the see them through the lens of today's maybe modern mental illness concerns?
Constructive to us, instructive to us in some way. One of the reasons that came about that I actually went through and looked at all that was because, I've had pastors tell me that they actually didn't believe mental health problems were real because they weren't in the Bible, which I kind of find laughable. But I thought, let's go in there and look. And they are. They're everywhere. And there's a lot of medical issues going on in the Bible. I think they're instructive to us because I think they help us understand that, these people that we've mythologized almost in some sense really were just normal people that were struggling with the same kind of issues that we're struggling with today. Yet God used them very powerfully, really despite their brokenness, and in many instances because of their brokenness, he used them. And, you could look at any number of people. Some are a little bit more controversial, because there may have been demonic influence involved. But, I think David is a great example. David, we have more information about David than just about any other character in the Bible. You have his own writings. You have historical accounts, third-party stuff. He's tremendously depressed, at least for the second half of his reign. I mean, he describes depressive symptoms all throughout the Psalms. I mean, one of the things that we often forget or really don't realize is that the majority of the Psalms that David wrote were Psalms of lament. We like to think about him dancing before the ark, but the reality is most of the time he's lamenting what's going on in his life and his connection to God and his relationships with his family. And, so he's very depressed throughout a great part of his life. And you have all types of individuals that struggle with mental health problems from, Samson shows all types of antisocial behavior. You've got Job and Jacob as people that deal with significant trauma and dealing with kind of post-traumatic stress issues. I mean, all of the symptoms are described there, and they're described really oftentimes in very common language. I mean, I tell people all the time, if you want to see what real suicidal ideation looks like, I mean, someone who is fighting the thoughts of wanting to die and wanting to kill themselves, you just have to read the third chapter of Job. I mean, it's suicidal ideation at its finest. I have literally had clients say some of the exact same things that Job says out loud there, wishing that they had never been born, that they had been stillborn. These are thoughts of someone who's really dealing with significant trauma and really wants to die. So I think what it does is it helps us understand that, these aren't issues of weak faith. These are issues of being human and living in a fallen world, and that God is present with us in our struggles, and yet he is also able to use us very powerfully for his kingdom.
Now, say more about that, that God can use us no matter what we've gone through. I think sometimes we assume, a mental disorder is going to prevent us from serving the Lord or being active in the church. I mean, you just mentioned there's shame and stigma there. What would be in your encouragement for someone that is feeling that way?
Well, I mean, I would say, you just have to look at some of these characters to be able to find, you can easily go through, like I said, and find depression throughout the description of David, yet David is a man after God's own heart. I mean, you look at someone like Job, who is desperately struggling with this trauma and post-traumatic stress issues. He's suicidal at times, yet God says that, he never sinned in anything he said or did. I mean, in this context of this event that we're having here, I mean, he was, he's the most righteous man of all the men of the East. I mean, these are people that God called out and to use, and while they struggled with these things, they were not looked down upon because of it. And so I think that's what we have to understand. These are opportunities to draw closer to God. These are not weak faith moments where we're farthest away from God. And so, we in the church has to kind of step back and stop trying to figure out why someone is the way they are or judge them. What we need to do is we need to show them grace, and we need to ask ourselves, how is God going to use this opportunity right now in this person's life and in my life to draw us closer to them?
Say a bit more about, you know, what could or should bearing one another's burdens look like in the context of someone's mental illness, maybe things that we should do and those that we shouldn't. I mean, we sort of touched on some of the don'ts, but say more about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to remember, like I said before, that people are more likely to go to a clergy or a church to look for assistance before they go to a mental health care provider or a physician. So, I mean, that's a divine opportunity like no other. So faith communities need to be prepared. They need to have relationships with the local mental health care providers that they have vetted, that they feel comfortable referring people to. They need to have support groups and those types of groups in place at their church that people can come in and receive the kind of encouragement and support that they need for the issues they're dealing with. Lay counseling teams, pastoral care teams, things that a lot of churches have. They just need to be prepared to be able to walk along with people who are struggling with mental health problems, and also need to have in place, you know, things for the family, support groups for families and opportunities for benevolence and care for the family. I mean, mental illness is often referred to as the no casserole illness. Because, I mean, you can say you have any kind of illness and someone will show up at your house with a casserole, but you tell them you have bipolar disorder and you won't see a casserole. I mean, they'll run for the hills. And so, you know, I think as a church, we just need to prepare ourselves ahead of time and realize that God is sending people with these problems to us first. I think individually, we each need to prepare ourselves to be able to demonstrate the grace of God. I mean, we need to not look at people the way the disciples looked at the blind man and want to know, why is he blind? Because he sinned or his parents sinned. They're less concerned about his suffering and more concerned about why, what he did wrong. And I think that's what we do with people with mental health problems. We need to be not worried about trying to fix somebody. We need to be worried about trying to walk along and carry their burdens. And so, you know, walking along, listening, not trying to fix, you know, just being present. You know, a lot of times people with depression, for instance, don't feel like they can pray. They don't feel worthy to pray. You know, lifting people up before the Lord, praying for someone and with someone. I mean, doing very simple things. Take them a casserole. You know, make mental illness, you know, take away the stigma of it being the no casserole illness. I mean, I know it sounds trivial, but I cannot tell you how much you would impact a family if you found out that their 28-year-old son just got out of a psychiatric hospital because he has bipolar disorder, and you showed up at their house with a casserole and you said, you know, how is John? I mean, that is transformative because that's what it is to be the church, you know, to really care, to be present. You know, I think we just have kind of missed the boat in a sense when it comes to mental illness with that.
Good insight today from Dr. Matthew Stanford. We're talking Grace for the Afflicted, a clinical and biblical perspective on mental illness. It's an updated, expanded version of this book. So maybe just a word about what you expanded and revised on this, Matthew, since it first came out.
Yeah, it came out originally in 2008. And in 2013, there was a new version of the diagnostics manual that we use in psychiatry and psychology to diagnose people. A new version of that manual came out. It's called the DSM, the Diagnostics and Statistical Manual. The fifth edition of it came out in 2013, and it dramatically altered the way that mental illness is diagnosed. There were new categories, and names were changed, and I mean, very dramatic alteration. And so the book is updated to that, to the new diagnostic criteria and naming. There's additional chapters. There's a chapter on suicide. There's a chapter on bipolar disorder, a chapter on post-traumatic stress disorder. There's additional chapters on how to set up a holistic approach to recovery for your loved one. What can you do at home for your loved one, such as you know, altering their diet and exercise, things like that. What can the church do? And then a whole set of new stories from believers that are struggling with these illnesses and how God's worked in their recovery. And then also, as we mentioned earlier, kind of in-depth kind of case studies of individuals in the scriptures that struggled with what appear to be these illnesses. I don't know if they were these illnesses or not, but within a modern diagnostic criteria, they seem to show the symptoms. And how is God working in their lives? And what did this illness, how did it affect their relationship with God? How did it affect them, their relationship with others? And how might we minister to somebody that's struggling with that?
Say a bit more about, as you mentioned, maybe diet, exercise. Are there some things that we can do beyond medication that is going to bring improvement? And maybe say a word about the value of medication, too, that we wouldn't question it in any other kind of disease.
Right. I think, you know, medication's wonderful. I mean, if you need it. I mean, I think that's the thing. There's a lot of overprescribing. There's a lot of overdiagnosis. But that doesn't minimize the severity of these illnesses. I think that, medication's just one tool. It's just one way that you can be treated, and a lot of times it's part of a broader scheme of therapy. So I think if medication can be effective for you and you're under the right kind of medical supervision, I think that can be very, very helpful. But there's a lot of lifestyle changes that you need to do, such as putting a support system around you, going to support groups, having supportive family and friends, effective diet. I mean, people that are on psychiatric medications also often gain a lot of weight. Part of the problem is because psychiatric medications can make you gain weight, but part of the problem also is they tend to eat a lot of processed food, kind of fast food, because they isolate themselves a lot and they don't take time to prepare food. So eating a healthy diet, staying very hydrated so you can clear the medication, exercise is very important, particularly for people with anxiety disorders. All these things I kind of mention in a chapter in the book, and we work with all of our clients to kind of, instill these kind of things into their life, because it really is about not only medication and therapeutic, kind of psychotherapeutic talking therapy, it's also about lifestyle changes and changing the way you're living so that you can manage your illness and that you can live a good quality of life.
We just have a minute or so left. There's been a lot of significant breakthroughs in brain research and such. Are you confident that we are making great progress in this area of understanding and maybe better diagnosis of mental illness?
Yeah, we really are. I mean, I think that, brain imaging has come a long way, and that's really, getting closer to where you'll be able to go to the doctor and they'll be able to image you and tell you what's going on. But probably even more exciting than that, and maybe even moving at a faster pace, is some of the genetic marker research. And there are even a few startup companies that are starting up right now because there are a few markers for depression that have been found. We're probably less than 20 years away, I would say, where you would be able to go to the doctor, have a genetic screen done, and not only would they be able to tell you that you had depression, but they would be able to tell you exactly what medication would be effective for you and which one would not. And perhaps one day even to the point that they would make a medication that would just be for you, that it would be a medication that would only work for you. It wouldn't work for anybody else because it's so specific to your particular kind of manifestation of what's going on. And that's really coming along very, very quickly.
Well, we're excited about the conversation today, and many listeners have called in, asked for a copy of the book. Matthew Stanford is a clinical neuroscientist. He's CEO of the Hope and Healing Center and Institute in Houston, Texas. Check out the website, hopeandhealingcenter.org, hopeandhealingcenter.org, and look for his book, Grace for the Afflicted, A Clinical and Biblical Perspective on Mental Illness, published by University. Matthew, thank you so much for coming on with us today and for encouraging us in this important area.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Connecting Faith, and we're going to continue the discussion on mental illness and the church in a moment. We're talking mental illness and the church's mission. That's the subtitle of a book from Amy Simpson, who wrote the book called Troubled Minds. And in light of our conversation just previously, I thought we'd share a segment of this interview from a past Connecting Faith. What would you say is maybe the first thing or ways that we can be more Christ-like in caring for those around us in our midst that suffer from mental illness?
Yeah, well, I think one of the reasons we tend to be so uncomfortable around mental illness and people with mental illness is because we tend to have certain expectations for what our church community should look like. And we have this emphasis on, how Jesus changed my life. Jesus gives me victory over sin. My relationship with Christ makes me happy. And we sort of subtly believe and send the message to others that that's what the Christian life is about. It's about being happy. It's about being attractive. It's about having a good life as we would define it here on earth. It's not really a biblical concept to believe that that's what the Christian life is all about. In fact, Jesus told us very clearly, you will have trouble in this life. You will suffer. The New Testament says that over and over again. Peter and Paul and these great apostles of the faith tell us, you will suffer. And God can do great things with your suffering, but you will suffer. So we need to change, first of all, change our expectations for what the Christian life is about, not only for ourselves, but for others. Because when we believe that the Christian life is about being happy and attractive and healthy all the time, then when someone doesn't fit that model, we tend to condemn them. So there's a lot of condemnation that falls on people who are affected by mental illness, as well as their family members, because when we have that sort of attitude, we assume that they must be doing something wrong, or that they have some kind of spiritual problem or a sin in their life that is at the root of their mental illness. So we need to revisit, I think, the most basic thing we need to do is revisit our theology of suffering and sin, and come to grips with the fact that mental illness really does fit perfectly with a Christian view of what this life is like, what we should expect in a world where our planet is polluted by sin and where all of us are subject to the forces of decay and disease. Even if we're in relationship with Jesus, that doesn't mean that we've been taken out of this world where the consequences of sin really have their way with people in many ways. So when we start changing that theology and start wrestling and acknowledging our own brokenness, I think we'll see a new humility in each of us that will give us a different attitude toward people affected by mental illness, and we can create a more healthy and loving environment that accepts people with mental illness as people who have problems that come as a result of the sin in this world, just like the rest of us do. And we're all brothers and sisters in Christ who are working toward God's kingdom and toward that ultimate redemption someday. And we all have great hope in that. And we're in this together.
But is it reasonable, though, to expect that or hope that someone gets better? I mean, we have, you know, churches have recovery programs, recovery groups. I mean, are we giving the wrong message here?
Yeah, it really depends on the person. There are some types of mental illness where people are more likely to have a true and lasting recovery. There are other types of illness like schizophrenia, like my mom has, where it's not reasonable to expect something that's a true recovery. It's more reasonable to expect the person to manage that illness over time. And that's the case with many. So when we have this this language of recovery, which is very appropriate to many problems in people's lives, but when we apply that same idea to people with mental illness, we're really placing kind of a false, heavy expectation on them that sends the message, you know, you can join with us in our community as a full part of this community once you've gotten over that. We don't really want you here until then. And that's the message that a lot of people with mental illness and their families have received from the church. We see your mess. We assume there's probably something wrong with you, something that you've done wrong to deserve that mess. Go get that fixed. Go recover from that. Maybe we'll help you get over it. And then once you're past that, then you can join us and be a member of Christ's body with the rest of us. Well, It's not reasonable for a lot of people, and it's not Christ-like. It's not a Christ-like attitude. Christ came to redeem all of us while we were still in our sin. He works with all of us. He loves all of us unconditionally, despite all of our messes that we have in all of our lives. And we need to do the same. We need to grant the same thing to each other. That doesn't mean that we don't have any expectations for people. I think it's very appropriate for us to set strong boundaries for people with mental illness, to set expectations for what is and is not acceptable within the community, and then to enforce those boundaries so that we can actually help aid in their management of their illness. That can be an important part of helping someone get better. But we need to be reasonable in those expectations and recognize when the expectations we have for other people are really just about our own comfort rather than truly the health of the body of Christ.
Can you give an example of where godly care is taking place, or a church or a pastor or somebody that you encountered and said, this is a good model?
Yeah, in Troubled Minds, I actually spend a whole chapter on ideas that churches can use, and profiled four different programs in different churches around the country who are doing a great job here. One example is, and I should say one thing that all of those churches have in common is that their ministries are led by people who themselves have experienced a mental illness or have a close family member who's experienced a mental illness. So people who've kind of gone through it are actually really well equipped to do ministry to others who are in that place. But one example I'll share, this man who had a struggle with serious depression, and when he came to his church for help, they basically, as he put it, they tried to pray it out of him. They chalked it up to a spiritual problem and blamed him for his illness, and then they were surprised and discouraged when he didn't get better as a result of their efforts to cure him with spiritual exercise. So he ended up leaving that church and going and getting medical intervention, getting medication, getting therapy, which his church had discouraged him from doing. When he made that choice, he felt like he was having to choose between the church and health, which we should never put anyone in that position. But he did get better. He the medication helped him, the therapy helped him, and he eventually was able to find a new church community where they were loving and accepting toward him despite the depression that he still struggled with off and on. Eventually, when he was in a very healthy place, he talked with people in the church. One of the pastors asked him to start a ministry to other people affected by mental illness as an outreach program from their church. Well, when he started announcing this outreach program to people in the church, all these people in his church kept coming to him secretly, like he said, like Nicodemus in the night, coming to him saying, "Don't tell anybody, but I struggle with this too," or "Please don't tell anyone, but someone in my family is suffering from a mental illness." No one felt like they could publicly say what they were going through, but there were all these people within his own church who themselves needed this kind of ministry. So it turned out to be not only an outreach program, but an internal ministry as well, and grew into a thriving program that is reaching, not only changing the families in his church, but reaching families outside the church and doing really fantastic life-giving ministry to them. And he's found a whole new purpose for and calling for his life. He does this full-time on staff with his church and just has a fantastic model in providing support groups and just helping people in those practical ways and helping them get that spiritual shepherding as they're going through treatment. One thing that we sometimes do is give people referrals to outside care, thinking they're getting all their needs met there, and then we've kind of done our job. But it's important for the church to recognize that sending someone to a psychologist or a psychiatrist or a counselor does not mean they're getting everything they need. We still need to walk alongside them as spiritual friends and spiritual directors, as pastors, and just people who are going to be in their lives as friends, offering friendship, not walking away from them and abandoning them when they need the church most.
Well, that conversation, you'll want to go back and listen to the full conversation with Amy Simpson. She serves as editor of Gifted for Leadership and writes for Christianity Today and Today's Christian Woman. She wrote a great book called Troubled Minds, Mental Illness and the Church's Mission. You can find that on the Connecting Faith show page. And we'll also post today's other interview we had earlier with Dr. Matthew Stanford, Grace for the Afflicted, a clinical and biblical perspective on mental illness. We'll get that posted here right after the show. Go to the Connecting Faith show page at myfaithradio.com.
And while you're there, you know, the word says to set our mind on things above. You can sign up for the verse of the day. You'll have a Bible verse delivered right to your inbox first thing every day from us at Faith Radio. So it's on the main page at myfaithradio.com.
That could be just the encouragement you need day by day. So check that out. If you're new to Faith Radio, by the way, we wanted to just say welcome. Got a great welcome packet for you. You can sign up for that at myfaithradio.com as well. Tomorrow, we're going to move into uncharted territory with Dr. Tim Elmore talking about marching off the map. I'll listen in for that on the next edition of Connecting Faith. Thanks for listening to this Connecting Faith podcast. These conversations are available because of listener support. And you can make a gift right now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of Connecting Faith, you can subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend and growing the awareness and impact of Connecting Faith.